Welcome to Reading Deadly Troubadours, the weekly podcast where I, Brent Thomas, read my novel, Deadly Troubadours. Let's begin, shall we? Chapter 3. Trist. The quest begins. The city of Trist was greatly trying to improve its image from a town rampant with thieves and pickpockets back into the town of mystique and romance, a town befitting its name. It did have a fair amount of charm with its surplus of crystal rivers, a well-blended populace that represented almost every corner of the 12 kingdoms. In addition, among its populace were a high percentage of those dedicating their lives to the arts and the belief that such an occupation added to the betterment of all. Not to mention that for a majority of the year, Trist weather was so fine it practically kissed one's skin. Scattered around the city was a bevy of cafes, lounges, eateries, grottos, dens, and other secret spots that offered picturesque views of whatever a patron would care to observe, be it sunset, stars, scenery, or slaves. The main reason it suffered such a harsh reputation for pickpockets and thieves is that, sadly, such sticky-fingered lurkers appreciated the glories of Trist as much as anyone, and so had flocked to the city in droves. In the most recent election, former praetor in the Imperial Army, Evert Trin, received an overwhelming mandate to become Lord of the Guard and transform the Tristian Guard from what they were, a gang of corrupt and incompetent slobs, into something more reputable. The disgraceful state of the Guard was a result of what the former Lord of the Guard had allowed them to become, as he lined his pockets with any and all bribes offered his way, and paid little heed to the training, funding, and maintaining of the Guard. Trin signaled to all that his would be a new breed of Guard, by making his first order of business the arrest and public flogging of his predecessor. Naturally, there was some fear that the former guards would resent Everett's devotion to order, his distaste of graft, and his preference for military precision. The less corrupt but still lazy members of the guard, who had signed in when it became clear to all that little was actually being expected of them, considered simply ignoring his decrees of change. The more corrupt members plotted mutinies, accidents, and even attempted a few assassinations on their lord guard. All such attempts failed, and when Trin announced that he would be bringing in 1,000 loyal soldiers from his former legion to augment the current 500 Trist guards, even the boldest of the mutineers realized that the change Trin had promised was the change he would deliver, and they decided it would be wiser and safer to simply resign their guards' commission. The change in policies and quality of the guard was also reflected in the change of the guards' appearance. Before, the guards, having had all their funds rerouted into personal coffers, were left to their own devices when it came to choosing arms and armor. The only defining characteristic of Trist guards was to be a bright yellow sash worn from left shoulder to right hip. Since much of the guard saw washing the yellow sashes as an unnecessary expense, the once brilliant color soon soured into a shade resembling a festering wound. The common nickname, Pussback, was a great indication of the respect Trist had for its guard. Trin dictated that his guard would be outfitted with bronze-scale jerkins, leaf-shaped shields, short swords, and distinctive long, conical helmets enameled in the brightest scarlet. His goal was to make the guards distinctive and easy to spot by the good citizens of Trist, should they ever need to call on them for aid. At first, there was snickering and mocking directed towards the unusual and eye-catching helms. Some quipped that the pus backs had simply been replaced by pimple heads. But within two turns of the moon, the guard's exceptional manner and skill, a result of Trin's strict training regimen, had won over the city. It was rare indeed to find an honest citizen who felt less than pride and assurance when they saw the conical helms of their scarlets making their way through the crowd. Likewise, the guards themselves had come to view their helmets as the symbol of their place in the social order. Most took special pride in polishing their headgear into a brilliant sheen. Tampering with a guard's helmet would be an insult. Stealing it, unthinkable. To do so would rouse the anger of all nearby scarlets and send them crashing after the foolish rogue who would dare commit such a deed. The only hope such a thief would have would be if they were more adept at taking advantage of the numerous secondary streets and alleys that wound their way through Trist. The maze-like network of corridors is easy to get turned around in under normal circumstances. Pursuit would be nigh impossible. However, the Scarlets are also noted for their in-depth knowledge of these corridors, again thanks to the strict training mandated by Lord Guard Trin. By contrast, if a thief had to make an escape, the outdoor market would not be a good place to attempt such an escape from insulted and angered city guards. For one thing, the market is very crowded. Even on days when trade is lightest, it is still crowded enough to make speedily wriggling past others difficult. Also, despite the large amount of valuable merchandise displayed by the vendors of the outdoor market, many of the tables used to display said valuable wares are of the flimsiest of quality. All it would take is a sudden bump to topple over a table of rare red cinnamon oranges. If a thief were to bump such a table and scatter, thus ruining the succulent and expensive fruit that combines sweet citrus and fiery cinnamon in the most pleasing of ways, then once he is inevitably caught, he will find his prison term and corresponding fine for violating the personage of a respected town official will be expanded to include a term in debtor's lockup until he can pay back the total sum of the damaged materials in addition to an apology fine. If it does not appear likely that the scamp will be able to repay the lost revenue, then a fierce whipping will be in order. Not to mention that many of the merchants can be just as inscrutable as the thief making the attempt escape. After getting caught by the guards, many other merchants will come forward insisting it was the same villain who took the missing gold-dipped ruby bracelet, or the absent fire-polished dragon scale belt, or other priceless baubles that the merchant had recorded in their ledger of goods, but that could not be found on their table. The thief, not possessing any such items on him, will simply be asked to offer proof that as a known scallywag that he did not throw the items into the bay rather than be caught with them. The guards, looking for reasons to further punish the thief for his insult, will consider his lack of proof of what he didn't do as confirmation of the merchant's claims. These additional missing items will be added onto his total debt for calculating his punishment. The city heads who maintain the outdoor market will reimburse the merchants, and the thief will be indentured to the market and will end up doing hard labor for the market until his beard is long enough to trip over. No, there is nothing positive about trying to slip through the outdoor market. It makes no sense whatsoever to even try it unless, of course, the primary goal is not to get away, but to attract an audience. However, to prioritize recognition over freedom would be very foolish for a thief. Demetrius Tate was one such fool. However, he did not consider himself as foolish. He preferred to think of it as daring. He would also little consider himself a thief, at least at the present. After all, lifting the guard's helm was more an act of play than an act of greed or gain. Those were the two motivating factors that, in his mind, made up being a thief. Embarrassing a guard was the action of a proper daring rogue, which is what Demetrius aspired to be. After all, he had ambition. His nimble feet skipped over a future teller's fate cards and danced between the silver merchant's cutlery. The cutlery slowed him down a tad, since he was certain anything larger than a salad fork would pierce the thin soles of his ragged boots. The guards, secure in their thick leather and iron of their boots, kept up their pace. If anything, they increased their speed, knowing that any damaged wares would either come out of their pay, or, if they could catch him, the little runt's hide. The chase continued past a wagon of carrots, a table of assorted wines, and over a chill cart containing sweet creams. Demetrius decided to gamble by circling around a fisherman's stand. All that stood between him and the panting guards were two tables of assorted sea life. The four guards wore matching red breastplates, pressed with the city's emblem. Three wore matching red helms. "Give it back, you little bastard," cursed the bare-headed guard. "As hot as you look adorned in your shell, I was merely trying to give you a cool breeze as charity." The quip was a stall. His eyes scanned the table, looking for the best diversion. Flinging at enemies carried the risk of pricking his own fingers on poisoned quills. Tossing trout would prove ineffective. His best option could prove to be just as much of a snare to him as a slowdown to the guards. But If it worked, it would make an excellent story, and that decided the matter for him. He splashed his arms into the large tank, the warm water soaking him up to the shoulders. He strained to lift the beast within, as its many arms resisted. The guards advanced, and just as all seemed lost, he wrestled the eight-armed mass free from the tank, flinging it at his pursuers. The octopus wrapped itself around the face of one of the guards, who frantically and uselessly pawed at it. Two of his companions started the arduous task of unwinding the beast. Demetrius began his retreat, with only the helmetless guard in pursuit. Demetrius darted past the few remaining merchants between the vendor and the edge of the marketplace as the guard lumbered behind him. All it would take is a few more paces, and he would reach another entrance into the maze of alleyways, where it would be a simple task to shake the murderous curses pursuing him. 5 steps from the alleys, and he allowed himself a smile. The smile was cut short, as a tug on his cloak squeezed it tight around his neck with such sudden force that Demetrius saw stars. As if no more than a paper ball, he found himself flung against an alley wall. He coughed out all the air he had, and his lungs fought to draw in more. "Got you now, you little rat!" Slumped on the ground as Demetrius was, the guard, already a larger and sturdier man, towered over him. A kick to the stomach reminded Demetrius of how sturdy guard boots were. He fought to remember how to breathe as his mind raced for options. A second kick convinced him he had only one. Tucked into his belt, where many practitioners of a roguish lifestyle fastened rapiers or short swords, Demetrius carried something more unique. It was a rod about 3 feet in length. Of its many details, the one that stood out was the crystal orb at the top. About the size of an apple, and similarly shaped, the orb contained a variety of dancing lights resembling the flickering glow of fireflies. Curled on the ground, he managed to free the rod from its loop and held it in his right hand between himself and the menacing guard. "What do you plan to do with that toy?" the guard questioned. The orb began to glow. With his left hand, Demetrius fished out a certain small piece of paper about the same size as the future teller's cards. On the paper was transcribed a very specific, very intricate combination of lines and curves. "Sleep," Demetrius commanded in a tongue little understood outside mage guilds. The ink on the paper began to glow and dissolved away the small sheet as the glow of the crystal orb itself grew in intensity. Like dousing a light, the guard toppled to the ground. The orb stopped glowing. Nothing was left on the paper. As the rogue regained his feet, he considered returning the helmet. Not only was it too large for him, but he had been forced to use magic to maintain it. The pain in his ribs convinced him that it was still a prize well earned, and that it would take him hours to prepare another spell. That's all for this week. Thank you for listening. Deadly Troubadours will soon be available as an ebook from most ebook retailers. If you want to hear more about me, Brent Thomas, you can visit my website at deadlytroubadour.com. You can also like me on Facebook by searching for the page Deadly Troubadours. This podcast is available at iTunes, so if you have a moment, please rate and review it. And while you're there, why not check out my other podcasts, such as Comics League International and the show I co-host, Living Japan. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at deadlytroubadour@gmail.com. Once again, thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in next week for the continuing adventures of the Deadly Troubadours.